Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. I've done a few episodes in the past on the Mafia. They're consistently some of the highest listened to episodes. But because we focus on older history here, I tend to shy away from it. Plus, there are other podcasts that concentrate almost exclusively on the subject and are able to paint a broad history of the mob from its origins all the way to its current incarnations better than I'm able to do in this format. But there is something about the Black Hand, that mysterious affiliation of Sicilian gangsters in America, especially at the turn of the century, just fascinates me to no end. And its structure and methods have always been of great interest to me. We touched on it in our Axeman of New Orleans episode, but when I came across the book that eventually became the subject of today's episode, I couldn't resist, and the fact that it comes with a real-life early Elliot Ness-style hero made it irresistible to me as a topic. I'm so happy to have as my guests today William Oldfield and Victoria Bruce, authors of the brand-new book called Inspector Oldfield and the Black Hand Society. It officially became available on August 21st. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
So I've never interviewed two authors at once. If you don't mind, I'll just ask questions as I usually do, and either of you can answer them, and then you can both add whatever you'd like, if that makes sense. So how did you come to collaborate on this book together?
Well, this is Victoria, and it's one of those stories of just a chance meeting in a coffee shop, I think, where a lot of deals are done these days. And, in walks this guy, and I'm in the middle of something, and he's bothering me, and he says, I have this great story. You look like a writer, and maybe you'd be interested in him. I'm rolling my eyes, and all of a sudden, William starts to talk about his great-grandfather, how he busted the first organized crime ring in America, and by the way, all of the evidence from the trial is back at my apartment down the street. So I'm, of course, like instantly dying and wanting to work on this book. And that was like 4 or 5 years ago.
This is William. I had started a small company about, 3 or 4 years ahead of, before that. And so the coffee shops became where you network and you ask, you occasionally meet people that are also entrepreneurs. It's sort of a field for entrepreneurs, And so I try to engage people, in coffee shops just to see what they're up to, and you never know, And I've been doing research for, since 2004. And I talked to so many agents and other writers and other people. And one gets to a point where there's so much evidence and so much information piled up that you think, I need to collaborate on this. You know, it needs to be a team effort, not just a single person. And that's how it started. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to start looking. And the worst thing that can happen is someone can say no. You know, well, Vicky Victoria said yes.
Well, congratulations on that. Book writing has always been such a solitary occupation, traditionally. I'm always fascinated by people who write books together. Who did what, and did you get along well through the process?
Go ahead, Vicky.
You want to go with that? Okay. So, I'll take this question. We sort of talked about, we talked a lot. So the beginning was, you know, basically William dumping boxes and boxes of research at my house that he'd done over 13 years. And he's like an incredible researcher. So it was a very comprehensive study, very comprehensive amount of material, including like real trial evidence, like death threat letters from the Sicilian mafia at the time, his great grandfather's case notes. You know, he was a post office inspector. And so, you know, we show in the book like this amazing amount of real life data and things that were used in the trial at the time. And so that's what I first started to look at. And at the same time, I would interview William, and I mean, he can tell you about that process. I was probably just hounding him constantly for more.
Well, like she said, like Vicky said, the family story, you know, intrigued me as a child, and of course, you know, how could it not? And when my mother passed away, she basically let me finally get that, before she passed away, get that final look, you know, at all the information. And my great-grandfather and his wife basically took everything home after the trial. Instead of leaving it, you know, in Washington at the in the archives or at the headquarters of the Department of the Post Office at the time, as it was called, and took it all home. And it was sort of unprecedented. It wasn't really common to do that. So I was stuck with actual stamps that says, you know, would say evidence, you know, item number one, whatever, and just it just stacked up and just huge piles of it. And huge amounts of newspaper articles that were sent by other inspectors from around the country to John Frank and his wife from other papers, even papers in Italy, actually, and in England, and put them in this big scrapbook as well. So we not only had all the letters and those things, but we also had, and the evidence, but we also had a mass amount of media of the time. And of course, back then everything was newspaper, so it was heavily sensationalized. And so when I did the research, I had to try to confirm, are these things, did they really happen? The reporters got the names wrong, or they embellished, or that sort of thing. And so Vicky would interview me of all these details, and then she had to dive in and confirm, because there were even names that were incorrect, as I said before. And we had to find out who was who and who did what. And it was just an amazing collaboration. Vicky, what about your rogues gallery, you know, to get familiar, you know?
Yeah, for about 4 months, you know, my whole family had to live with basically a rogues gallery. It was like a lineup. I would make a full-size, you know, portrait of these guys' mugshots and put them in the living room, put their names on them, put where they were from, and tried to organize in a way, because there was so much. There were so many mafiosos. There were so many lawmen that it was just so confusing for me at first. And I had to put names to faces to locations. So that was actually really fun. I liked it. I would have left it up, but my husband wouldn't let me.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about that in a little bit. A rogues gallery is an absolutely perfect description of this collection of characters in the Society of the Banana, which we'll talk about shortly. But before we get there, I'd like to ask you about this. I'm guessing most people don't associate the U.S. Post Office with crime fighting and law enforcement, but there was and is a law enforcement hand to the organization. And it really becomes a heroic organization in your story. So set this up for us, if you could. What was the role of post office inspector, especially at the beginning of American history? And if you could, tell us what made that position special within the realm of law enforcement.
Well, I can take that initially. When I first talked to Vicki, she had that same question. Who are these guys? What do they do? Where'd they come from? And why were they able to do what they were able to do, and even today what they do? Well, Vicki can go into some of the details as well, but at the very beginning of the post office, with William Goddard and Benjamin Franklin, William Goddard didn't get the job he thought he was going to get, which was to be the first postmaster. Ben Franklin was given that role. William Goddard was given the job as what they called surveyor back then. So he was the first post office inspector, if you want to call it that. And number one, badge number one. And his job was to create the routes, identify dangerous areas, identify distances, and all these details, audit the individual post office's finances as they were built. In addition to that role, since it became a cabinet-level agency or department in the U.S. government at one point, where the postmaster actually sat on the cabinet of the president, because it was so important. And treaties were made also overseas, as the United States grew, and the post office had to have secure ways to send mail and money and other things around the world, as well as across the United States. So as that occurred, the post office inspector, the role, became more and more important. And because of these treaties, and it was going across the new state lines across the country, it became the most powerful law enforcement position of any type in the country. And at the time when Frank Oldfield became post office inspector number 156 since William Goddard, so it shows you there really aren't that many of them. At that point, you had the Secret Service, the U.S. Marshals, and a budding, just beginning research organization, investigative organization called the FBI, which really had no other authority except to do support for the other law enforcement agencies. And so the post office inspector was able to use any form of transportation, could take another person's vehicle or commercial vehicle and give a chit or a promise, basically a signed promise that he would return it, to do whatever was necessary to capture a criminal. And since everything was done through the post office, including moving the Federal Reserve's money, all gold, everything, any currency, everything was transported by the post office, the inspector basically had carte blanche across all forms of crime, because everything used the post, and anything used the post was under their jurisdiction. And that's how it grew to that kind of power and ability to then, secondly, go to any local law enforcement and to recruit them under federal authority to be part of the investigation. If you want to build a posse, I guess it would be a great way to explain it.
Fascinating. So I'd like to ask you more about Frank Oldfield. Tell us about his life and the events that eventually led him to the Postal Service.
I think as his great-grandson, William, you should take that one, because the stories that he told about that were just so enthralling to me, and that really in the book, you kind of fall in love with this character, you know, and he's just such a dynamic guy that I'll let William sort of talk about his background.
And I want to add real quick here, one of the great things about your book, a lot of true crime nonfiction focuses on a notorious murder or murderer, but yours really centers around Frank Oldfield, this crime-fighting hero.
I think that's wonderful to see it that way. We saw it that way as well. There were so many interesting characters on the pro and the negative, you know, the positive and the negative side of this investigation. And in a sense, they were almost rogues on both sides. Now, Frank, as a young man, his father, my great-great-grandfather, Hamilton, where I got my nickname Hammy, had been in the Civil War as more of a desk jockey. And because of that, early Republican Party, and at the time Republican politics out in Maryland, and also Democrat politics, was a lot of, you know, you got your appointments, you know, so if you were a friend. So let's just cut to the chase. And Frank started out working for his father in some of the mills that he had, and was always a very dapper guy. So that wasn't sort of his blue collar thing, wasn't really, you know, wasn't his style. So he was always looking for an opportunity to get involved in other things like politics or, you know, some other profession. Well, his father was granted a post office franchise through his relationship in the Republican Party in Maryland. And immediately Frank was given a job as a clerk there. And a post office clerk back in the day was actually a pretty prestigious and well-paying job, responsible for money and fiduciary responsibilities, that sort of thing. So you were kind of important. And any relationship with the federal government went through the post office. If you needed something, you know, something from Washington or whatever, it always came through that local office. So you were sort of the intermediary, the middleman between the federal government and the people in any community. So Frank seemed to love that and enjoyed, I think, some of that responsibility. Made him a little bit larger in life, I think. You know, it builds up your internal, your ego a bit. Well, what happened was is that he had also, you know, run for other offices, that sort of thing. I won't get into all the details because we'll reveal everything in the book. But he tried other forms of politics, got himself in trouble, got himself a big name and then a nefarious name. And so he had sort of a colored, interesting past. Once he became a post office clerk, though, everything sort of stabilized. And then the opportunity came to him to become, you know, become appointed a post office inspector. And that, I think, was the best thing that ever happened to him, because you're very autonomous as an inspector and no one's telling you what to do and you can be your own boss. And I really think that that's sort of in the blood even today in our family. We all love to be entrepreneurs. And because of all his political wranglings, he and his brother and his father, it looked to me like actually he was appointed to kind of remove him or to get him out of the picture so other Republicans could take offices and power and whatnot. So they shipped him off to Chattanooga, you know, which from Ellicott City, Maryland, back in that day was a haul. It was a long way. So it was sort of like putting him out in the pasture. Well, he did a great job chasing bad guys down there and stagecrackers and postal robbers and all sorts of train robbers and all sorts of other nefarious characters. But he still remained involved in Ellicott City and Howard County, Maryland politics, which was a no-no. As an inspector, you're supposed to relinquish all those because it was considered unethical. Well, he got caught, and the Post Office Inspection Service, the chief inspector and the postmaster, had him removed. He's the only post office inspector ever to be fired and removed. And in his original record, there's a giant handwritten letters removed at the top of his file. It's pretty funny. And then about a year later, with quite a bit of wrangling by, I think, his father and other people, he was reinstated and supposedly out of politics. And they were shipped off to the Cincinnati domicile, Southern Ohio, and where he actually shined and really did a great job there, and was even asked by the service to investigate as an impartial inspector, investigate corruption in the New York City area post office, which turned into another rogue situation where he got in a fight with the assistant district attorney, who was actually involved with one of his relatives in some of the corruption. And then once he got shipped back to Ohio, he just went back to the normal routine of auditing post offices like Ben Goddard did, looking at routes, making sure finances were correct, occasionally getting a great opportunity to chase a bad guy. But normally it's pretty boring. Until 1908, and if Vicky, if you want to hit from there, you've got to you really know about what happened in 1908. So,
well, I think that was a good primer, and then you know the exciting part came in. But I'll let Eric ask us more questions about that.
Okay.
Yeah, you paint a great picture of him. He was a man of action, right? He wasn't someone who liked to sit behind a desk and push paper.
Absolutely. We've sort of discovered that. We all talked about that in our family lore, you know, how exciting he was. But when we found out what a post office inspector's primary role was, we thought, how did he, could he handle that? Like I said, all the paperwork and the audits and the boring things like that, working with postmasters to make sure all the stamps were counted, that kind of thing. It's very boring, you know, that part of the work. And he was looking for excitement, like you said, and you know, he absolutely lit up and was dogged and definitely an intrapreneur inside the post office, because when he took over an investigation, he used the practices that they had available, which were highly complex at the time, from handwriting analysis to even stakeouts to a number of other identification techniques, you know, that they had that were ahead of their time around the world. But he also made his own rules. In other words, to make sure, basically almost like the concept of, I'm going to be dogged and I'm going to get my man. I'm going to catch him regardless of what it takes.
So this is such an interesting time period for organized crime. These are the very, very early beginnings of the mafia. Far, far different than what we know it to be now. And it was very much a strange foreign entity, this influx of Sicilian criminals. And period law enforcement agencies really struggled with this. And to make matters more difficult, there were really no Italian-American police officers or detectives to deal with this sharp rise in crime associated with these groups. One of the really interesting stories you tell, and forgive me if I mispronounce his name, involves Francis DiMeo, who eventually joins the Pinkertons and has his own compelling arc as well, and even joins forces with Frank Oldfield later on. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, DiMeo almost deserves his own book because he was so fabulous. So back in around 1905, there was the LAPD was aware of what you just talked about. They needed Italian detectives to infiltrate the Italian crime that was going on in the city, Manhattan and Brooklyn, and they hired a guy named Joe Petrosino, who was actually on the NYPD, and he was known to be a real tough guy. And the Pinkertons were a national detective agency, but they were government contractors, so they would hire out to private industry and also government industry. And they also realized about the same time that, wow, we don't have anybody. We've got, actually they realized it earlier than the NYPD. They said, we need somebody who's Italian, because a lot of these corporations were getting hit by mafia-type extortions, their employees, kidnappings and things like that. And the two brothers, the Pinkerton brothers, who owned the company after their father passed away, they were friends with a New Orleans chief of police named Chief Hennessy, who was murdered. And this is post-Civil War. So we're talking, you know, a decade before the turn of the century. And it turned out to be a crime, an Italian sort of mob crime that killed the police chief. The Pinkertons went out and they said, we really need to find somebody of Italian descent who can solve this crime and infiltrate these gangs, because, yeah, you're absolutely right. There were no Italian detectives on the police in New Orleans or really anywhere else around the country. So DiMeo, Francis DiMeo, goes down there and he is this amazing undercover artist. And he studies a character who's a counterfeiter and gets himself imprisoned in the New Orleans Parish Prison, this filthy, dirty place. You know, here he was surrounded by all these mafiosos that were waiting for trial, and he was terribly ill. He dropped 30 pounds. He had dysentery. And when the Secret Service were passing messages saying, do you want to get out? We need to save your life. He said, no way, I'm staying. And he knew he was really close to cracking the case. And he ends up really getting a guy to confess to that murder and one of the big crime families that was down in New Orleans. So the Sicilian Mafia actually really starts in New Orleans post-Civil War. And that's another thing that's fascinating that we tell about in the book.
Now, I did an episode a few months ago about the Axemen of New Orleans, and I'm sure you're familiar with that story. We did have a little bit of a discussion on the Black Hand in that episode, but I think a refresher here is important. Could you define the Black Hand? What was it exactly?
So I can give it a try at this one. The concept comes from all the way back to Sicily before Italy actually came together. So all the way back, hundreds of years, actually. And the concept of the hand of death, the Black Hand, was used to terrorize families, basically extort them for quite a while. And then, of course, let's move to people immigrating to the United States. You have a massive Italian immigration to the United States. And, of course, the Sicilian bad guys always follow, they got to follow the money. So they continue the concept of that terror organization, putting terror into mainly Italian families and especially business owners. And, of course, they're paying what some people call, the insurance today, the insurance business, where you're basically protecting you're protecting them against yourself. They're paying you to protect themselves against you. But that's how it really starts. And they use the La Mano Nera, they use terrible drawings of knives and daggers and actually Black Hand graphics, drawn on the paper, either pin them to their doors with a dagger and then continue to harass. And eventually the concept of the hand of death, or the Black Hand, usually creates a friend, which is the term used by the Black Hand of any business or person who begins to pay. And they refer to them as a friend amongst the gangsters themselves. Say, well, so-and-so DiCamilli family or the Fassone family, they're now friends of ours. So friend DiCamilli is working, is providing us support. And what I meant by support, of course, was he's giving them money. And that's really where the Black Hand starts, but they really hadn't branched off into all the other areas of the modern mafia from Prohibition on, where they diversified. This was mainly just an insurance racket and terror to take control over territory and money. And if people did not comply, it was a very brutal follow-through from stabbings, beheadings, bombings, quite a bit of a very violent activity. The longer they've been in the country, the more violent they are.
We will be right back.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906, when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from 2 Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have returned. So let's get a little more specific now. Could you talk about the Society of the Banana and the Lima family? This was a very real organization that operated under the umbrella of the Black Hand, right?
Right. So the Lima, so Sam Lima is our notorious bad guy. He's the sort of self-appointed president of the Society of the Banana. And they call themselves the Society of the Banana because going all the way back to New Orleans, they were fruit dealers. So the Sicilians took over the fruit trade from South America, around the country, and really a lot of them became prosperous. So under the guise of being a fruit seller, Sam Lima and his father, Antonio Lima, his brother-in-law, Sebastian, also named Lima, gets confusing, they all have this little fruit store in Marion, Ohio, tiny little town. And they go there because they have really, you know, the police there are not a threat to them at all. They become ingratiated in the community. They, you know, they're just, they have lots of money in the bank, obviously. And, you know, everybody likes them in town. And what they do is they go to other cities around Columbus and they terrorize people, as William was saying. You know, they bomb, establishments, they kidnap, they maim, they murder. And, but, you know, Sam Lima on his own is a dad. He looks like the American dream. He's got a wife and kids and a storefront and sells bananas. So they're, you know, in sort of a comical way, they call themselves the Society of the Banana, this one group. And also they sign their letters, the Black Hand, but internally they are the Society of the Banana, and that's how they address each other. And, part of William's collection, and we have copies in the book of these letters that say, you know, be careful, don't send any banana bills. They're scheming. We need to steam the banana bills, with all this code of language that has to do with fruit sellers. So, you know, with Sam Lima at the top, you had guys in all other, like Cincinnati and Columbus and Meadville, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And, you know, this is a far-reaching, organized crime ring, and no police believed that was true. They always thought that these were random murders, random kidnappings, and so on.
And Sam Lima was kind of a struggling artist as well, wasn't he? Can you describe some of these drawings he would scratch out on his letters?
yeah, a couple of them. You know, you'd see like a little cartoon coffin and a heart, like drawing the organ of a heart, not like a, you know, Valentine heart. And then with a dagger slashing through them, blood dripping off it. And, you know, sometimes there were, you know, there was red blood stains on the letters themselves. So he must have like pricked his finger to add a little drama and flair.
So the Society's primary means of making money, as you've already mentioned, shaking down families, small business owners, extorting money from them. When is Frank Oldfield turned on to all of this? How does he take this on as a case, and how does this develop into a crusade for him?
Well, Vicki, take that one again, because from what I referred before, how boring it was for Frank, and I'll and how detailed it was for him. And then finally in 1908, he gets a really, really fun opportunity.
What happened, I think, you know, Frank was upset because, you know, like we talked about before, he had no way to infiltrate Italian crime. So the police knew what was happening. The post office detective knew. And, you know, this was a bothersome to him because there was almost nothing, case that he took that he couldn't finish. And when a murder happened in, where was that in Ohio?
The Sierra murder, Denison.
Bellefontaine.
Bellefontaine, yes.
Yeah. And so this guy is murdered in his fruit store, and in his pockets are these death threat letters. So, you know, Frank, because there are letters, the local police came, handed them over to Frank and said, okay, then this is in your ballpark now because it's now a federal crime. And what are you going to do about it? Well, you know, Frank, pasty white, 5'4", 120 pounds soaking wet, you know, not speaking Italian, not a lick of it, you know, goes into these Italian communities. And he tries to interview people. No one will talk to him, you know, so he's getting more and more aggravated. And that went on for a year, and he hadn't had a single break in that case. So the big case, now Sam Lima and all his cohorts start going after people with a vengeance. And when Sam Lima took over the Society of the Banana, I mean, they were doing literally tens of thousands of dollars of extortion from numerous victims. Finally, they picked the wrong one, and that was this guy named John Amacon, who was an Italian fruit seller, a multimillionaire in Columbus, and he was not having it. And he got this letter, and he's like, there is no way, because I will not pay. They can kill me first. And while other Italians were afraid to go to the police and afraid to say anything against the mafia, the Black Hand, he wasn't. And he ends up in Frank's office, you know, this big portly guy, and he looks at this little, you know, scrawny Caucasian detective, and he says, you know, I want to see Uncle Sam. And, you know, Uncle Sam referring to the government man, and he wanted help. And he said that he would testify, and that's how Frank was able to finally break into the case.
So the Society of the Banana doesn't get wind of this right away, do they? That Amacon has gone to the authorities. And they're able to keep their investigation secret for a while. But Lima doesn't take it well when Amacon doesn't pay, right? And he continues to escalate his threats, even bombing his porch. Is that right?
William, you want to take that one?
Oh, yes, of course. You were doing so well. Well, it starts out, you've got Lima and a couple of his cohorts decide to come down to Marion, Ohio. They're not getting any response from Amacon. And so they go down there, and they stand across the street from his very large warehouse on Naughton Street, stand across from it with their arms folded, you know, looking nefarious, and encounter John and his brother Charlie. And no fist fight or anything, but there's conversation, and it's a semi-polite conversation where you know your enemies, but there's other people walking by. And it's a great interchange between them. Well, very soon afterwards, we start getting some problems. Marcino's Saloon, which is basically where all the people that work at Amacon's large fruit warehouse, distribution warehouse, it gets blown up, dynamited. You know, poor Marcino, probably, it's difficult for us to find all the facts, but they used to hang out in the back of his saloon, so it looks like he at least tolerated them, but they must have used him to threaten John, because John was the big money person, John Amacon. And that didn't work. So then they go after Charlie's house, and basically his wife finds a stick of dynamite inside of a newspaper. So that one doesn't go off. But there are subsequent threats where they'll come by the house at night, now that John and Charlie both have police protection now at their house, chasing off these guys at night on the other side of the gate or in the bushes or whatever. Eventually, the back porch is blown up on one of the houses, and it still doesn't work, you know, but it starts waking up, and there's a point where you really identify with Lima, actually, and his other cohorts, they absolutely saw themselves as completely untouchable. They called law enforcement buzzards. So you showed how they, you know, in their letters, it shows how they felt about them. And there's this back and forth between Amakon and Lima, where these two, Lima saw himself as just as big and just as powerful as Rockefeller and Carnegie and John Amakon, the American Dream. You know, that he's going to be a powerful man just like they are. And Amakon was already there. He was already a powerful and successful man. You know, so there was a rivalry, and I think a little chip on his shoulder as well on Lima's side, because he hadn't reached the level of success yet that Amakon had. And then when Oldfield is brought in, you know, he actually breaks every rule in the book and immediately does some investigating, but very soon after starts talking to the press. And Vicky really discovered what he did with the media. If you want to explain that, and that's how they really interact with Amakon and Lima and Oldfield, it becomes this public battle.
I think that is fun. That's a fun part of the story. You know, you watch Frank, he's such a strategist, you know, and he knows how to work the newspaper men, and, you know, they kind of want to stay on his good side so they can get the inside scoops. And at the same time, you know, he sort of plays the bad guys off one another, calling this guy the head of the band. We're going to catch him because he's the one running everything, when he knows that's not true. And so, you know, it's just a very, very fun story that, you know, you just can't believe that he was putting all these pieces together at once and making it work.
One of the things you mentioned before was this cast of killers and oddballs that made up the Society of the Banana. And in your book, you describe them one by one. Were there any of these characters that stuck out to you most, that were especially interesting to you?
Well, I think for me, you know, Sam Lima is the one we know the most about because he was the godfather. And what's funny is Frank has notes on him, and, you know, there are newspaper articles about what he said in court. You know, he like publicly says how he's going to kill people, you know, in the middle of the courtroom. And what's really cool is that, you know, we sort of live with these guys William has for 13 years, 14 years, and I have for the past 4 years. And, at the end, you know, there's an epilogue, but all of them stood out as really interesting characters. You know, you've got, the one that I have a crush on is the guy who was, born on my birthday in, I don't know, 1880 or something like that, but Peppino Galbo, you know, he's so handsome, and he's got this arched eyebrow and a scar across his cheek and his diamond thick pin, you know, and he, you know, was just a well-loved person in the community. Everybody thought he had a legitimate business. So there, you know, each character has like this wonderful personality to us, even though they were murderers, you know, and you can't forgive that of what they did, but they all have, you know, very layered personalities. And in the end, you know, we turned in the book, William and I, we're like exhausted, you know, here it is. And our publisher came back and said, okay, but I want to know what happened to all of them. And honestly, we were exhausted, but at the same time, it was something that I always wanted to do. But you can imagine, that's a whole nother month of research, you know, to find out what happened to them. And what happened to Sam Lima, I'm not even going to give it away, because that was really cool to find out. But the readers will have to buy the book and read it for that.
I just quickly, I wanted, my favorite character growing up as a child in our family lore, and the first picture that was ever shown to me, probably at 10 or 12 years old, was Salvatore Arrigo. And this guy was the old man. You know, if you see all the Godfather movies, I mean, he's an old guy. And he's been in the business a long time. And he's just a colorful character. He looks the part. I mean, the photograph of him with a black shirt on, you know, it's just the best. And he's like 65 years old, you know. He's been convicted. He's been in jail multiple times. You know, he's seen it all. And I love that about his character. And they actually, on March 9th, they all meet and they retire him and they elect a new godfather. But it's the first time ever that any investigator ever was able to stake out a meeting of all the main captains and head of the mafia from all around the country. They get together and they retire good old Salvatore Rico, and they picked somebody else to run the show. And, you know, 50, 40 years before the famous Poconos meeting that we all hear about, you know?
Yeah, I was just about to ask you about that meeting. It was basically a who's who of early Sicilian gangsters. And as you mentioned, they elected someone to take over the society. I guess I have a two-part question. How did Oldfield learn about this meeting, number one? And then question number two, once this meeting took place, Oldfield and company were able to discover a lot of new information about the organization. And this is probably my favorite part of the book. They learned some of the laws and regulations of the Society of the Banana. And I was hoping you might summarize this strange set of rules they followed.
So the meeting, we found through, you know, detail going through his case notes and his reports and everything that Frank Oldfield actually had an informant on the inside. And that was something we didn't know at first going in. Like, how did he find out about this meeting? Because they were able to stake out a meeting when they had, you know, 14 mafiosos coming from all parts of, you know, the Midwest. And how did that happen? So later on, we find out that he had an informant, and we still don't know who that was. So at that point, you know, he was able to set up across the street. He was able to set up at the train station, and he had his fellow inspectors with him by this time. It's not just him. He's got a whole sort of army of lawmen from different agencies. And so that was really spectacular. Like William says, that's the first known mafia meeting that was ever witnessed by law enforcement. And it's 1909, so it's way earlier than anything we think of. And I'll let William talk about the other part of your question.
You have to repeat the other part for me again. I'm sorry.
The laws and regulations of the society.
Okay, that particular one. Okay, well, what happened was Salvatore Lima, who went by Sam, it was common to call him that, you know, that day. He basically had during the invitations to the meeting. What happened was that the Postal Service quickly was able to use their clerks, everybody else, to track their letters, and they were opening, and they were able to, get some of the letters, the invitation letters, and take a peek at them, and then seal them back up and put them back out. And at the time, you had to have, you know, it was sort of a warrant related thing with the, you know, they had to do, but it gave them some ideas to Stan Limit saying that, hey, I'm now the controller. You know, I'm the boss now. And during the meeting, that's confirmed. You know, when they all agree to that, he puts a letter out to everybody saying that we agreed to that, that I'm now sort of the controller. There's a figurehead godfather, but I'm sort of the guy that runs the business, you know, the COO, if you want to call it. And so what happened during the meeting is it went on through the night, you know, all the way into the next day. They had to go out and get cots. And what they did is they sat down, they worked out how we're going to share money, that sort of thing. But they also worked out, what are going to be the rules of how we run this national business? How's the money going to go back to Palermo, you know, to supply the bigger bosses there, that kind of thing. And so they started out with articles, just like the U.S. Constitution, you know, and it actually Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, it's the best thing you've ever seen in your life. And it's very funny. Article 1 says, basically, if you ever reveal that this gang exists or this organization exists, you know, you'll be killed. And then the second article basically refers to another infraction, but the punishment is referred back to Article 1. So, you know, which is death. And it just goes on, what, you know, article after article, each one of them having a punishment. One of those punishments, you will be categorized as removed from the organization and categorized as a swindler. And the swindler, that must have been a horrible thing to be called back then, you know. That the whole community will know that now that you're a swindler. And I thought, my gosh, it must be terrible to know that you're a swindler. You know, but they're almost comical, each one of them, as they progress through the, you know, through the articles. And at the time, if you look at it, before we had amendments, that sort of thing, there's almost the same exact number of articles in this Constitution as in the U.S. Constitution. So I'm wondering if Sam Lima really was following the American dream, looked at the U.S. Constitution. He probably read it, and, you know, it'll help back then, because they all did. They were all given it as part of their naturalization and that sort of thing. They said, I'm going to create my own. this is my own country, my own government. And it really is amazing how he took sort of that initiative. And by the way, can you imagine the personal ego you have to have, the strength? You have to see yourself as a president of a nation to have that kind of confidence that you're going to write a constitution, you know.
And they're very specific about some of their punishments. One of them is loss of membership accompanied by getting stabbed.
Yes, he shall be stabbed.
And another one includes getting branded on the face.
And then the last one, I don't know if you remember the last one, is there will be some consideration taken to cases of inebriation or intoxication.
So you're excused occasionally if you say something bad about the gang or talk about it in public if you're drunk. Okay.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it really is comical, but you see how also their level of education, you can also tell, is not very high. So they have sort of a salt of the earth concept of value, of who has value, you know, how someone's punished when they don't add value to the gang, you know, that sort of thing. Kind of almost a country, rural, you know, sort of a vigilante style justice within their own organization, you know, very informal. But it was codified, so we have to give them credit for that, you know, into the Constitution.
And again, I know we only have an hour together today, and we're running a little short on time right now, but Oldfield puts together this crack team, and it reminds me a little of the Untouchables. He handpicks a group, each with unique skills and contributions, and DeMeo, who you told us about a little earlier, joins them. He's extremely valuable, of course, because he speaks Italian, can blend in far better than the others. And you have a chapter called The Takedown, where these hoods are brought down one by one. There is a trial, and that's what I'd like to ask you about. What is the smoking gun evidence that prosecutors use to eventually prove their case?
So, you know, from the beginning, Frank Oldfield's only sure thing as far as evidence was John Amicon's testimony, but then he also needed to show hard evidence. So he needed to show that there was, you know, a direct link from Sam Lima and an extortion letter that went to John Amicon. So through this very, very complicated scheme, they were able to follow a letter directly from Marion, Ohio, mailed by Sam Lima, that ended up going through a second person because they would actually put it undercover and in another letter send it, and then that person would open it and resend it. So it never came from the original sender, and that went directly to John Amicon, and they had marked the stamp, and that was one of the tools they used were marking the stamp. So they followed it, and so that was the piece of evidence that ended up convicting all of the 11 that were convicted. Three were given new trials. But they were able to say, you know, this happened, and then all the rest of them were convicted on conspiracy charges. So they didn't have direct evidence. So Frank actually got really lucky that, you know, they had conspiracy charges, which is what happens a lot of times. So it was mail fraud, which, you know, Sam Lima gets the longest sentence of 16 years, and then the rest of them as well with lesser sentences.
What's pretty sad about the whole thing is this is a group of guys who committed extortion, terror, assault, murder, and their sentences ultimately weren't very long, were they?
No, and I think it's similar to tax evasion, you know, Al Capone, and, you know, because when you have local law enforcement or state law enforcement, it's much easier, more, you know, it's easier to corrupt those institutions if you have a lot of money, like these mobsters did. So, you know, they had to go after them with these federal crimes that really had very, very small sentences. And so 16 years was the longest. And, yeah, there were murders and kidnappings and all of that. But it was mail fraud, which is what took them down.
So the Black Hand, the Society of the Banana, what would their legacy ultimately be? I mean, is there a direct connection between their organization and later Italian gangsters in New York, Chicago, the rest of the country?
Yes, actually, the Black Hand is the mafia. They're basically one and the same. And the Sicilian mafia, that is, not the Napolitano, you know, from Naples or you know, other groups, but the Sicilian mafia basically matures from the Black Hand concept of extortion. After some of these guys get out of prison, wherever they are in the country, there were a number of Black Hand individual cases. You know, local guys would get arrested in, say, Chicago or New York or whatever, and they weren't really in larger gangs. But they would, that went on till into the till Prohibition started. The Black Hand, you still saw Black Hand arrests. And once some of these guys, because they couldn't really get them for the larger crimes, it was very rare they caught them, as Victoria said, but for murder or the larger, longer-term crimes, once they got out of jail, they continued their, you know, their business. And as they became more sophisticated and media started calling them new names, they sort of took on the, you know, the colorful new names. Like I said, the syndicate, the mob, whatever. They, you know, they didn't call themselves that. That was the media sensationalizing it in the papers, you know, to sell papers, to create all those names. But what happened was, as you'll find out in our epilogue, Sam Lima and many of these other people, as well as thousands of others around the country, continued in, you know, to what you see as the mafia today. The Black Hand was the foundation of the Sicilian mob that we, you know, know and love in all of our movies and all of our TV shows.
So you said Frank Oldfield was your great-grandfather?
Great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather. This was quite a feather in his cap for his career, right? What happened to him after this?
Frank, the post office inspector, was a political appointee. Frank rankled quite a few people because of his concept of getting things done regardless of what it took to get it done. So he rankled a lot of traditionalists and career people within the Postal Service. So in 1911, after his father died, he resigned in November 1911. And from can you imagine what a great career, you know, for a pension and everything else, and took the entrepreneurial risk of, because of all his notoriety, and he'd got a lot of attention in the papers, for a much higher private investigation role. And and what happened was, is this case launched his career as a private investigator to the rich and famous, from the Carnegies to the Rockefellers to the Boltons to, you know, all the Great Lakes big industrialists, the Strong family and the Reading Railroad in Pennsylvania. And it really allowed him to make a very, very good income compared to what he had made before. In fact, one customer in particular, this in the Strong family, just the first year was approximately five times what he made in a normal year. Just that one customer. So, you know, when he was with the Postal Inspection Service. So that's what happened. And he basically continued all the way until his untimely early death in 1916. So that career was very short, but it was well traveled across the country. He took cases everywhere. And really, and also brought his son, sometimes would bring his sons or a son with him to look like a father and son, you know, as a cover for a stakeout, that kind of thing. Quite a colorful career after the inspection service.
So the book dropped yesterday, August 21st. Where should we direct people who want to learn more about the story and your book?
Yeah, I have a website, victoriabruce.com, that has links to buy the book at, you know, online booksellers, and it'll be wherever books are sold, in your local bookstores, independent and chain Barnes & Noble type bookstores. And we are doing a lot of events. We'll be in, on the 24th, we will be in Washington, D.C. at Politics and Prose at 7 p.m., we will be in Annapolis, Maryland on the 25th. And if you go to my website, victoriabruce.com, I have a calendar in it. Hopefully we will be in a city near some of your listeners, and we would love to meet you and hear how you like the book.
Perfect. And this was great that we were able to coordinate with all of our schedules. And there's a ton of information we weren't able to cover in this conversation. So buy the book to get the entire story. Thanks again.
Thank you, Eric. We really appreciate you doing this.
Eric, thank you so much. This is wonderful. My entire family thanks you. We've been waiting 100 years to get this story out, and it's people like you that are letting us tell this amazing tale.
Again, I've been speaking to William Oldfield and Victoria Bruce, authors of Inspector Oldfield and the Black Hand Society. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.